Welcome to this deep dive, really focusing in on IBD. And we're going to be using this IBD revision document that you sent over as our jumping off point. So as you know, our listeners are gearing up for the SCE exam.
Right.
And we want to really distill this down into the most high yield information for them.
Absolutely. We're going to respect your time. You know this stuff already.
Right.
We just need to highlight those really key points that are going to help you succeed.
Exactly. And, you know, we were looking through this document and there was some really interesting data, especially when it comes to ulcerative colitis,
right,
about colectomy rates. So just to give some examples, for extensive colitis, the 10-year colectomy rate is 19%.
Wow.
Compared to 8% for left-sided colitis.
Okay.
And only 5% for proctitis.
Yeah. And that really highlights the importance of recognizing that UC is a dynamic condition, right? It can progress over time.
Exactly.
What starts as maybe a localized inflammation can become more extensive. And that, of course, will change how we manage it long term.
Absolutely. And it's not just about treating what we see right now.
Right.
But thinking about what could happen down the road.
Exactly.
And one of the things I thought was really fascinating is that it mentions how about half of those who are diagnosed initially with proctitis or proctosigmoiditis may go on to develop more extensive disease.
Wow.
And even more striking, 10% of those presenting with proctitis will develop extensive colitis.
So it can be a really progressive disease for some folks.
It really can.
And that emphasizes the need for careful monitoring and proactive management. You know, the document also highlights a few key risk factors for colectomy that, you know, as folks are preparing for their exam, might want to keep in mind. Male gender, for example, younger age at diagnosis, and then the presence of elevated inflammatory markers.
And then, of course, there's always that challenge of relapse. I mean, a striking 90% of patients with UC experience relapse.
It's incredibly common, unfortunately.
And if it happens within the first 2 years, it can be associated with a worse prognosis.
Absolutely. So early intervention and those effective maintenance therapies are really key. And the document goes into quite a bit of detail about those. So,
yeah. So let's talk about some of the specific treatments now.
Sure.
So for mild to moderate UC, 5-ASA, you know, that's really considered the first line.
Absolutely. That's the cornerstone.
And it's not just about symptom control. I mean, the document mentions this great statistic. It can actually reduce colorectal cancer risk by 50%.
That's a really important point. You know, when we're talking about 5-ASA, we're not just thinking about symptoms. We're thinking about long-term outcomes. And the document recommends, you know, typically a dosage of 2 to 3 grams daily, often supplemented with enemas as well. But of course, with 5-ASA, we always have to think about renal function.
Right, right. So those baseline renal function tests are crucial with repeat assessments at 2 to 3 months, and then annually after that.
And then in practice, of course, the choice between suppositories and enemas often comes up, right? The document helps to clarify that a little bit. Suppositories are preferred for rectal disease, whereas enemas tend to be more effective when the sigmoid or distal descending colon is involved.
Now, let's talk about those more acute situations, ASUC.
Okay.
The document gives a very specific definition of toxic megacolon, and I think that's something that's important for our listeners to remember.
Absolutely. And they may be asked to define it, right?
Right.
So it's defined as a diameter of greater than 5.5 centimeters at the transverse colon or greater than 9 centimeters at the cecum.
And with a 35% risk of perforation?
Yeah.
This is that to act fast.
Absolutely. This is a situation that requires immediate attention. And you know, the document emphasizes, first and foremost, correct those electrolytes.
Right.
Hypomagnesemia, hypokalemia, common in these patients, and they can actually worsen the condition.
And we also want to avoid any medications that could worsen that colonic dilation.
Right. So we're thinking about those NSAIDs, opiates, anticholinergics, antidiarrheals. All of those can have a detrimental effect on the colon.
And then the document also talks about the Travis criteria.
Yes.
Which can help predict the need for colectomy after the patient's had 3 days of IV steroids.
Yeah. And again, you know, this might be something that they ask about specifically on the exam. So really good to commit to memory. And the criteria are a CRP greater than 45 milligrams per liter.
Okay.
Stool frequency between 3 and 8 per day. or a stool frequency greater than 8 per day.
And that indicates a very high probability, like 85% of needing a colectomy.
That's right. So really helpful in guiding those clinical decisions.
And then moving on from there, the document discusses the Mayo score, which is so important for assessing disease activity in UC.
And it's really nicely designed. You know, it takes into account the stool frequency, rectal bleeding, endoscopic findings, and also the physician's global assessment.
So let's unpack those components a bit more. When we're talking about stool frequency, it's really relative to the patient's normal.
Right. It's personalized.
So we need to know what their baseline is.
Exactly.
When we're talking about rectal bleeding, it can range from no blood at all to visible blood passed without stool.
So that gives us a sense of the severity, right?
Right. Right. And then the endoscopic subscore, that focuses on the severity of the mucosal inflammation. So from a normal appearance all the way to severe disease, we're thinking about ulcerations.
And then, of course, you have that physician's global assessment, which allows us to use our clinical judgment, looking at the patient's overall presentation.
Right. And then based on that, you can categorize disease activity into mild, moderate, or severe, which then helps guide treatment decisions.
Right. So mild would be a score of 3 to 5.
Okay.
6 to 10 is moderate. And then 11 to 16 would be severe.
And the document also defines clinical response, clinical remission, and mucosal healing, which are sometimes terms that can be a little confusing.
Absolutely. Good to clarify those.
For example, clinical remission is a Mayo score of 2 or less.
Okay.
With no individual subscore exceeding 1.
So you're looking for improvement across the board, right?
Exactly. And then mucosal healing is defined as an endoscopic subscore of 1 or less.
Really highlighting the importance of getting that inflammation under control at the endoscopic level.
Mm-hmm. So now let's delve into the world of specific medications
that
we use for UC. The document starts off talking about sulfasalazine, and it describes the mechanism of action.
Yeah, and just to refresh everyone's memory, sulfasalazine relies on the OSO bond being broken down by those colonic bacteria to release its active components.
No, it's effective, but of course, like many drugs, it can have some side effects.
Absolutely. And the document lists quite a few, you know, some of those common ones, nausea, headache. But then you have those more serious ones as well, pancreatitis, hepatitis, agranulocytosis, folate deficiency, even aplastic anemia. So, you know, really underscores the importance of careful monitoring, thinking about those potential risks.
Then the document talks about mesalazine.
Yes.
It points out that the delayed release formulations use a pH-dependent release. So it targets the ileum and the colon where it's needed the most.
Right, where the inflammation is.
Now, mesalazine is generally pretty well tolerated.
Yeah.
But there are some potential side effects, nausea, abdominal pain, headaches.
Mm-hmm.
And one that I thought was really interesting is that it mentions about 3% of patients have this paradoxical worsening of colitis.
Oh, yeah.
Which should be treated like an allergic reaction.
Right. And it's important to recognize that because you might think, oh, the medication's not working, but it could actually be making things worse.
Right. So, you know, another one to watch out for. And then, of course, just like with sulfasalazine, monitoring renal function is important.
Mm-hmm.
The document then moves on to steroids.
Yes.
And highlights their efficacy in inducing remission.
Yeah. They're our go-to for those severe cases.
Right. Especially those intravenous corticosteroids.
Yeah. It really helps to dampen down that inflammation quickly.
It specifically mentions MMX butsinide as a potential option for left-sided colitis.
But it's important to note that ileal release butsinide hasn't been as successful. And in fact, some studies have shown it to be inferior to placebo.
Right. So really important to know the nuances there.
Absolutely. And the document does a good job of highlighting those.
Now we move on to cyclosporine.
Okay.
It mentions that the typical dosage for AS use is 2 mg/kg.
Okay.
But it really stresses the importance of knowing those contraindications.
Right. So things like chronic kidney disease, hypertension, malignancy, severe hepatic impairment, uncontrolled infection. So again, we're thinking about those patients who might be more vulnerable to side effects.
And then the document discusses when we might escalate therapy to thiopurines or biologics.
Right. So when do we move to those more potent agents?
And it outlines a few situations. The need for IV steroids or cyclosporine for induction, requiring a second course of steroids within a year.
Okay.
The presence of steroid-dependent or steroid-refractory disease or having ASC.
Right. So those are all situations where our conventional therapies just might not be enough.
Now, it's very clear that methotrexate has no role in treating ulcerative colitis.
Right. That's one we can rule out.
So one less thing to remember. So let's move on to thiopurines.
Okay. So when we're talking about thiopurines in UC, we're mainly thinking about azathioprine and mercaptopurine. And those typical dosages for azathioprine, 2 to 2.5 milligrams per kilogram daily.
Okay.
And mercaptopurine, 1 to 1.25 milligrams per kilogram daily. And that's assuming they have normal TPMT activity.
Right. TPMT testing is so crucial.
Yeah.
When we're thinking about thiopurine therapy.
It plays such a key role in how those drugs are metabolized.
Exactly. And that can really impact both efficacy and toxicity.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, the document reminds us that about 90% of patients have normal TPMT activity.
Okay.
So we can go ahead and use those standard doses. But then you have those with intermediate or absent activity, which requires a little more thought. You know, about 10% are heterozygotes with low activity. So they would need a 50% dose reduction. And then a very small percentage, about 0.3%, are homozygotes with completely absent activity. So they can't take thiopurines at all.
It's amazing how these genetics play such a key role in management.
Oh, it's incredible, you know, how personalized medicine has become.
Now, even with normal TPMT activity, there's still that small risk of myelosuppression.
Right.
And the document mentions about a 0.1% risk of neutropenia.
So we still need to monitor these patients, even if their TPMT activity is normal.
And we can't forget about the other potential side effects of thiopurines.
Oh, there's a whole list.
Pancreatitis.
Like symptom.
Abnormal LFTs.
Myelotoxicity. And the document provides really detailed guidance on managing those side effects.
Right. It emphasizes the importance of monitoring those thiopurine metabolites, adjusting the dose accordingly.
Right. So, for example, if a patient develops pancreatitis while on azathioprine, you stop the drug right away.
Right.
If they're experiencing nausea and vomiting, you might think about switching to mercaptopurine, splitting the dose, or maybe using a low-dose azathioprine with allopurinol.
For those with new LFT abnormalities, we stop azathioprine, we investigate, and then we might consider rechallenging with a low-dose azathioprine allopurinol once those LFTs have normalized.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, myelotoxicity, we're monitoring that CBC, that ANC. If the white count drops below 3.5 or the ANC falls below 2, then we hold the thiopurine until those counts recover. And for those severe cases where that ANC falls below 1, we need to really educate the patient about the signs and symptoms of infection.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, they need to know what to look for, and they need to seek medical attention immediately if they develop any of those signs.
Right, right. And then, of course, beyond these more immediate side effects, we have to think about the long-term risks.
Right. So we're talking about
non-melanotic skin cancers
and T-cell lymphoma. And that risk is particularly increased in young men.
So monitoring, monitoring, monitoring.
That's the key takeaway.
Exactly. So those blood tests, that full blood count, urea and electrolytes, liver function tests at 2, 4, 8, 12 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And then every 3 months after that.
Really important to catch those side effects early.
And then the document discusses the interesting relationship between allopurinol and azathioprine.
Yeah, this is where it gets a little bit tricky, but also really interesting.
So allopurinol can actually help make azathioprine more effective.
Right, it's like we're fine-tuning the azathioprine.
Exactly.
So allopurinol inhibits both TPMT and xanthine oxidase, which shifts more of that azathioprine toward its active metabolite, 6th iguanine nucleotide.
Right.
And that leads to greater incorporation of 6th iguanine nucleotide into the DNA.
Okay.
Ultimately reducing white cell replication, including those T lymphocytes, those key players in that inflammatory cascade.
Now let's switch gears and talk about perchitis.
Okay.
Which is a common complication for patients with ileal pouch anal anastomosis.
And it can be quite debilitating for some patients.
It really can.
Right.
And the document highlights a few key points. It notes that patients with PSC have a higher risk of developing pouchitis. And it also mentions an interesting observation regarding liver transplantation.
Oh, yeah.
So those who have an endileostomy after a colectomy tend to have better liver graft outcomes.
Interesting.
Compared to those with IPAA.
So that's an important consideration for those patients who are dealing with both IBD and liver disease.
The document also mentions the impact of IPA on fertility. And it points out that it can actually lead to worse fertility outcomes compared to other surgical options.
So, again, something to keep in mind for those younger patients where fertility is a major concern.
And it even suggests considering a subtotal colectomy with ileorectal anastomosis as an alternative But it acknowledges that there is that residual risk of neoplasia in the rectum. Mm-hmm. So always a trade-off.
Yeah.
Now, for treating acute pouchitis, the document is very clear. It recommends 2 weeks of ciprofloxacin as the first-line therapy and metronidazole as a second-line option.
Makes sense. Hit it hard with those antibiotics.
For chronic pouchitis, the approach tends to be more complex and individualized.
Yeah, you have to tailor it to the patient.
Often using a combination of antibiotics like ciprofloxacin, metronidazole, tinidazole, rifaximin. You might also use budesonide or beclomethasone, either orally or topically.
Okay.
And then probiotics, particularly those with Streptococcus thermophilus, Bifidobacterium species, Lactobacillus species, are considered for secondary prophylaxis.
So a multi-pronged approach there.
It really is.
Yeah.
Now, surveillance is crucial in pouch management.
Absolutely. We need to keep a close eye on these patients.
And the document lists criteria for deciding who needs annual pouch surveillance.
Okay. So who are those high-risk patients?
So those with a history of IBD-associated cancer, a family history of colorectal cancer.
Okay.
Type C allele changes.
Which is basically severe pouchitis that develops very quickly after pouch formation with moderate to severe villus atrophy.
A long retained rectal cuff or PSC.
So those are all red flags that we need to be aware of.
Right. So those are patients who need that close annual monitoring.
Makes sense. And what about for those who are considered low risk?
So for them, the surveillance can be less frequent, usually every 5 years or even not at all. Really depending on the individual circumstances.
Yeah, shared decision-making really comes into play there.
Okay, so let's switch gears now and talk about Crohn's disease.
All right, sounds good.
So the document mentions a prevalence of 5 to 10 per 100,000 for Crohn's. And it points out that it's actually more prevalent in black populations compared to UC.
That's an interesting distinction, yeah.
And unlike UC, Crohn's disease demonstrates a female predominance.
Yeah, it's more common in women than men.
And that genetic susceptibility is significant, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It ranges from 9 to 15%.
Wow.
And it can be as high as 30%.
Okay.
If both parents have IBD.
And again, the Ashkenazi Jewish population has an increased susceptibility.
They're definitely at higher risk for both UC and Crohn's.
Now, the document highlights some risk factors for progressive disease in Crohn's that I think are really important.
Absolutely. Things to keep in mind when you're assessing patients. So age under 40, for example, continued tobacco use, perianal or rectal disease, and requiring glucocorticoids to manage the disease. All of those can signal a more aggressive course.
And that 10-year risk of surgical resection for Crohn's is quite sobering, almost 50%.
Yeah, it's a stark reminder of the potential morbidity associated with Crohn's.
Now, when it comes to diagnosis, it emphasizes that MRI small bowel is preferred over capsule endoscopy.
Right, and that's mainly because of that risk of capsule retention, especially in patients with known or suspected stricturing disease.
And MR enterography is really the preferred way to assess those bowel habit changes in small bowel Crohn's.
Yeah, it gives us that really clear picture of the bowel wall, those surrounding structures, and really tells us about the extent and nature of the inflammation.
And then let's not forget about those histological features.
Oh yeah, the microscopic picture is important.
And help us distinguish Crohn's disease, lymphocytic infiltrates,
lymphoid aggregates, and of course the presence of those non-caseating granulomas.
Those granulomas are so helpful, right?
They can be, yeah. But it's important to remember that their absence doesn't rule out Crohn's.
Right, right.
Yeah.
And the document does a good job of going into the details of those specific microscopic features that we're looking for, particularly in the colon.
Yeah, so things like focal or discontinuous chronic inflammation.
Right.
Focal crypt irregularity.
Right, that discontinuous crypt distortion.
Exactly. And then, of course, the presence of granulomas not associated with crypt injury.
Mm-hmm. And those same features,
yeah,
along with irregular villus architecture.
Yep.
Can be used to diagnose Crohn's disease in the ileum.
So those endoscopic biopsies are really valuable.
They are. And then it introduces the Montreal classification.
Right. A really important tool.
Which helps us categorize Crohn's disease based on location and perianal disease.
Gives us that standardized framework for describing this complex condition.
Right. So A1 refers to ileal disease.
A2 is colonic.
A3 is ileocolonic.
Gives us that clear anatomical picture.
B1 is non-stricturing. Non-penetrating.
Okay.
B2 is stricturing.
B3 is penetrating.
And then P is added if there's perianal disease.
So it paints a really complete picture of the disease.
It really does. Now let's move on to treatment options for Crohn's.
Okay, so what are our tools in the toolbox?
The document mentions that elemental or polymeric diets have similar levels of evidence for efficacy. Steroids, particularly budesonide, are often used.
Yeah, especially for that A1 disease, that isolated ileal involvement.
Now, fistulae.
Oh, yes, those can be a real challenge.
They can affect up to half of all patients.
And 90% of those with rectal involvement.
So if they have rectal involvement, it's very likely they're going to have a fistula at some point.
And the document does a really nice job of outlining the approach to fistula management. First and foremost, we need to rule out active inflammation.
Right, so usually a colonoscopy or sometimes an MRI.
And then once we've addressed that active inflammation, we can think about the fistula itself.
So first line is usually acetin line placement and antibiotics to control the infection.
So we're trying to drain that fistula tract, prevent it from closing up prematurely, and get rid of any bacteria that might be lurking in there.
And if that doesn't work?
Yeah, if that initial approach isn't successful, then we move on to immunotherapy.
Right, and azathioprine.
And infliximab are mentioned as potential options. Both of those work by modulating the immune response.
And then for those pesky oral aphthous ulcers.
Those can be so uncomfortable.
They can be. The document recommends topical corticosteroids as the first line treatment.
So something like hydrocortisone lozenges deliver that medication right to those ulcers.
Now, managing Crohn's post-surgery can be tricky.
Yeah, absolutely.
The document introduces the Rutgerd score, which is used to assess that risk of post-op recurrence.
And that's based on what we see endoscopically at that anastomosis site.
Right, so a score of zero, which means a perfectly normal anastomosis.
That's the best case scenario.
Right, less than 5% risk of recurrence at 5 years.
So a very good prognosis.
Score of one, meaning fewer than five ulcers at the anastomosis.
Also a low recurrence risk.
Less than 5% at 5 years.
So those are our two lowest risk categories.
Well, a score of two
means
there are more than five ulcers, but with normal mucosa in between.
Okay.
And that carries a higher risk, about 20% at 5 years.
So the risk starts to creep up there.
And then a score of three is concerning because it indicates diffuse ileitis.
Yeah, more widespread inflammation.
And the recurrence risk jumps to about 63% at 5 years.
So that's a significant jump.
And finally, a score of four, which means diffuse inflammation with large ulcers and or stricturing that's associated with the highest risk of recurrence, approaching 100% at 5 years.
So that Rutgerd score is really helpful for stratifying those patients.
Absolutely.
And figuring out who needs more aggressive management.
And then the document goes on to present those ECO and ESG guidelines for post-op prophylactic treatment.
So what do those guidelines recommend?
So the ECKO guidelines take that risk stratified approach
and
recommend restarting azathioprine or an anti-TNF therapy if the patient has at least one risk factor for recurrence.
So smoking, for example?
Prior intestinal surgery, the absence of prophylactic treatment during that initial surgery.
Penetrating disease at the time of surgery, perianal disease.
Granulomas in the resection specimen.
And myenteric plexitis.
The BSG guidelines are a bit more straightforward. They recommend a 3-month course of metronidazole for everybody, regardless of risk factors. But if the patient is a smoker or has two or more of those risk factors, then they advise adding additional prophylactic treatment.
So smoking, again, rears its ugly head.
It really does. Now, before we go into some of those more general concepts that are relevant to both UC and CD.
Yeah, let's broaden our scope a bit.
The document gives us some really interesting insights into epidemiology and immunology.
Yeah, I think that'll be helpful for folks to just kind of round out their understanding.
Yeah, I'm ready to expand my knowledge base.
Yeah, okay, let's do it. So it mentions that the peak incidence of IBD occurs between 20 and 40 years of age.
Okay.
Which is, you know, a key demographic to keep in mind when you're seeing younger patients presenting with GI symptoms.
Yeah, because IBD often gets, I don't know, lumped in with conditions that are more common in older adults. But this is a reminder that it can happen.
It can definitely affect young people.
During those prime years.
Absolutely. And the document also talks about the geographical distribution of IBD. Mm. So more common in Western countries, less common in the Asia-Pacific region.
Okay.
And there's this interesting decreasing prevalence gradient from north to south, suggesting that environmental factors likely play a role.
It makes you think about that interplay.
Oh, absolutely.
Between genetics, environment, and the immune system.
It's so complex.
It really is.
And, you know, the document also compares IBD prevalence across different ethnicities. Mm-hmm. It points out that Black individuals have a lower overall incidence of IBD compared to white individuals.
Wow.
But within the Black population, Crohn's disease is actually more prevalent than ulcerative colitis.
Hmm. And then, as we saw earlier, the Jewish population, particularly Ashkenazi Jews, have a much higher susceptibility.
Right, significantly higher.
To both ulcerative colitis and Crohn's.
Yes, definitely at increased risk there.
Now let's talk about some of the immunology.
Okay, let's dive into the immune system.
Of IBD, because this document does a nice job of explaining the role of specific cytokines.
Yeah, those signaling molecules.
Right, they're like those messengers that tell the immune cells what to do.
Exactly. And in Crohn's disease, we see higher levels of interferon gamma and IL-2 compared to ulcerative colitis.
Hmm.
And these cytokines are really important in driving that Th1 immune response that's characteristic of Crohn's.
So that's a helpful distinction
to remember
for those tricky exam questions.
Right, because they love to ask about those subtle differences.
They do.
Between UC and Crohn's.
Now, the document further breaks down that inflammatory cytokine profile in Crohn's disease.
Involving both Th1 cells, which produce cytokines like IL-1, IL-2, IL-6, and TNF-alpha,
right,
and Th17 cells, which produce IL-17 and IL-23.
And IL-23 is a particularly important one because it amplifies that inflammatory response, making it a key target for some of those newer biologics.
It's amazing how understanding these intricate immune pathways has led to the development of such targeted therapies.
Oh, it's incredible the progress that's been made.
It really is.
Now let's switch gears to a topic that's particularly relevant for women with IBD.
Okay.
And that's pregnancy.
Pregnancy, yeah, it's a big concern.
It is. And the document provides some reassuring information. So several medications that we commonly use to manage IBD are actually considered safe during pregnancy.
That's good to know.
So steroids, azathioprine, infliximab.
Okay, so those are all good to go.
Yeah, they got a good safety profile.
Now, are there any exceptions to that?
Yeah, so cyclosporin, we have to be a bit more cautious with because of the risk of low birth weight.
In infants. And then methotrexate's a no-go because of those teratogenic effects.
Right. Right. So those are important to keep in mind.
Absolutely.
Now, the document also discusses the risk of relapse after stopping infliximab therapy.
Yeah, because that's something we often think about.
Yes.
You know, when can we safely stop these medications? And it identifies several risk factors. So male sex, for example.
Yeah, okay.
The absence of previous surgery, a white blood cell count greater than 5, a CRP greater than 5, hemoglobin less than 145, and a calprotectin level greater than 300.
So we're looking at gender, surgical history, and those markers of inflammation.
Exactly.
And if a patient has any two of these risk factors, their chance of relapsing within a year of stopping infliximab jumps to 15%.
That's a significant increase.
Yeah, it is.
So it really emphasizes the need to carefully consider those factors
right
when we're making decisions about stopping infliximab.
It's really about that personalized approach.
Absolutely.
You know, each patient is different.
One size does not fit all.
Now, going back to this document, let's talk about surveillance colonoscopy.
Okay, yeah, that's a big one.
Which is relevant to both UC and CD.
Right, we need to keep an eye on things.
And it emphasizes that surveillance colonoscopy should begin 10 years after diagnosis.
Okay.
But it also points out that the ECCO guidelines recommend starting a bit earlier.
Yeah, they say 8 years from the onset of symptoms.
So do we have a consensus on which one is better?
You know, it really depends on the individual patient, their risk factors, and clinical judgment. But the ECCO guidelines also advocate for using dye spray and taking targeted biopsies during those surveillance colonoscopies.
And what happens if dysplasia is detected?
So the document's very clear on this. For visible dysplasia, the recommendation is to resect, regardless of the grade.
Yeah.
And that's not just for surveillance colonoscopies.
Right.
That's anytime we see visible dysplasia, we take it out.
So no debate there.
Resection is the standard of care.
What about invisible dysplasia?
So invisible dysplasia, a little more nuance there. The recommendation is to repeat the colonoscopy at shorter intervals.
Okay.
Usually every 6 to 12 months to monitor for any progression.
So it's about that balance, right?
Absolutely.
Between missing something that could progress to cancer.
Right. We don't want to miss anything.
And then the risks of repeat procedures.
Yeah, it's a judgment call.
Now, the document makes a very important point.
Mm.
Always consider colectomy.
Yeah.
especially in cases of high-grade dysplasia.
Because that risk of progression to cancer is just too high.
It's too high to ignore.
Absolutely.
Now let's move on to a topic that I think sometimes gets overlooked, and that's extraintestinal manifestations, or EIMs.
Yeah, these can really impact a patient's quality of life.
They can, and up to 30% of patients experience them.
It's a significant portion of our patients.
It is, and the document does a nice job of categorizing them based on their relationship to disease activity.
Right, because some of them will flare up when the IBD is active.
Right, right. So erythema nodosum.
Aphthous ulcers.
Episcleritis, arthropathy.
Those tend to go along with the gut inflammation.
So it's like they're mirroring what's happening in the gut.
Exactly.
Now, others are independent.
Yeah, they do their own thing.
Like pyoderma gangrenosum.
Uveitis, PSC, sacroiliitis.
And those can occur even when the IBD is in remission.
Which can be so frustrating for patients.
You really can.
But, you know, the document does mention that even those independent ones might show some improvement with treatments like steroids or anti-TNF therapy.
So there's still hope.
There's always hope.
Let's talk about some specific EIMs.
All right, let's get into the details.
Let's start with arthritis.
Okay, yeah, a common one.
And it can present in different ways, right?
Right, depending on which joints are involved and its relationship to that disease activity.
The document distinguishes between large joint oligoarthritis and small joint polyarthritis.
Yeah, and that's a really important distinction to make.
So large joint oligoarthritis, that tends to run with the disease activity.
Right. It flares when the IBD flares, quiets down when the IBD is quiet.
So if we can control the IBD,
yeah,
we can control the arthritis.
Often, yes.
But small joint polyarthritis,
that one's independent.
So we might need additional therapies, even if the IBD is quiet.
Exactly. We have to treat it separately.
Now, pyoderma gangrenosum.
Oh, yeah, that can be a tough one.
Those characteristic painful ulcers.
Yeah, they're often described as serpiginous.
Right, that snake-like appearance.
Yeah, with those violaceous borders.
That can be pretty scary looking for patients.
They can be, and what's challenging is that there's no one-size-fits-all treatment.
So what are some of the options?
So topical steroids are often the first line.
Okay.
And topical tacrolimus might be considered as well.
Okay.
And for those really severe cases, we might have to go with systemic immunosuppression.
Okay. So again, tailored to the severity.
Absolutely.
What about erythema nodosum?
So erythema nodosum typically presents as those tender red nodules, usually on the shins, more common in women. And interestingly, it can also be a side effect of infliximab.
So that's something to consider.
Yeah, if you have a patient on infliximab who develops erythema nodosum, don't automatically assume it's their Crohn's acting up.
Right. Could be the medication. And then mouth ulcers.
Yeah, those are so common.
They are.
But the differential can be broad.
It can. So what are we thinking about there?
Well, the document reminds us to consider Behçet's disease.
Okay.
Especially if the patient also has diarrhea.
Right.
Behçet's is a systemic vasculitis that can cause that triad of mouth ulcers, genital ulcers, and uveitis.
So we got to ask about those genital ulcers.
Absolutely. It's important to get the full picture.
Now, this document provides a really helpful table.
Oh, yeah. I like this table.
That outlines the recommended frequency of surveillance colonoscopy based on disease extent, activity, past findings, and family history.
Yeah, it's a good reference.
So for extensive ulcerative colitis with moderate or severe activity.
We're talking annual colonoscopy.
Okay.
For extensive disease with mild activity.
Every 3 years.
Every 3 years.
So the more extensive the disease, the more active it is.
The more we need to keep an eye on things.
Right. Makes sense.
If the extensive disease is quiet, then every 5 years is usually sufficient.
Okay.
But if they have strictures or dysplasia in the past 5 years, then we bump that up to every 3 years.
Okay. So those are higher risk features.
Absolutely.
What about for left-sided colitis?
So for left-sided, the recommendations are a little less stringent.
Okay.
Typically every 5 years.
Okay.
But family history of colorectal cancer also plays a role.
So if they have a first-degree relative diagnosed under the age of 50.
Then we do a colonoscopy every 3 years.
Okay.
If it was over the age of 50.
Every 5 years.
Every 5 years.
And then, of course, if they have PSC.
Yeah, that bumps it up to annually.
Annually, okay.
So PSC, extensive disease, high disease activity, history of strictures or dysplasia, and that family history of early onset colorectal cancer, those are all red flags.
Those are our red flags.
That tell us we need to be more vigilant with our surveillance.
Now let's go back to Crohn's disease.
Okay.
Specifically those fistulae.
Yeah, those can be so challenging.
And again, up to half of all Crohn's patients will develop them.
And 90% of those with rectal involvement.
So again, if they have rectal disease, very likely they're going to have a fistula.
It's almost a given
And the first step?
is to rule out that active inflammation.
Right, so colonoscopy or maybe an MRI.
And then once that's addressed,
We can focus on the fistula itself.
see it in placement.
That's our first line approach
Antibiotics.
to control that infection.
Right. So we drain the fistula. We give those antibiotics.
And we make sure that underlying Crohn's disease is under control.
Right. Because that's the key.
It's like fixing the leaky faucet.
Exactly. You can mop up the water all you want, but if you don't fix the leak, the problem's going to keep coming back.
Now, what if those initial measures don't work?
Then we have to think about immunotherapy
Right, so azathioprine.
or 6-mercaptopurine.
And if those aren't enough?
Then it might have to go to those biologics like infliximab or adalimumab.
And sometimes surgery is unavoidable.
Yeah, especially for those complex fistulae that just don't respond to anything else.
And again, these are decisions that are made in conjunction with our surgical colleagues. It's
Absolutely.
a team approach.
Multidisciplinary care at its best.
Now let's revisit those oral aphthous ulcers.
Yeah, because those can really make eating a misery.
They can. And the document recommends topical corticosteroids.
Right, so those hydrocortisone lozenges can provide some nice relief.
Okay.
Deliver that medication right where it's needed.
Now let's move on to post-op management of Crohn's.
All right, another challenging area.
It is because that risk of recurrence is high.
It is, unfortunately.
And the document talks about that Rudgeard score.
Yeah, to assess that risk.
So just to recap, a score of 0 perfectly healed anastomosis.
Lowest risk, less than 5% recurrence at 5 years.
Score of 1, fewer than 5 ulcers.
Also a low risk, less than 5% at 5 years.
Score of 2, more than 5 ulcers with normal mucosa in between.
That risk starts to go up about 20% at 5 years.
Score of 3, diffuse ileitis.
Yeah, that's when we start to get worried. 63% recurrence at 5 years.
And a score of 4, diffuse inflammation with large ulcers and/or stricturing. That's the highest risk.
Approaching 100% recurrence at 5 years.
So that Rudgeard score really helps us stratify these patients.
Yeah, so we can tailor our management accordingly.
And then the document talks about those ESICO and BSG guidelines for post-op prophylactic treatment.
So what do they recommend?
ESICO recommends restarting azathioprine or an anti-TNF therapy if they have at least one risk factor.
Right, so smoking, prior surgery,
Absence of prophylaxis during that initial surgery, penetrating disease.
perianal disease, granulomas in the specimen, myenteric plexitis.
BSG recommends 3 months of metronidazole for everyone. But if they're a smoker or have two or more of those risk factors, then they add additional therapy.
So smoking, again, plays a big role
It does, it does.
in those postoperative outcomes.
Now, the document wraps up with some important points about overall IBD management.
Yeah, it's not just about treating the gut.
Right, it's about the whole person.
It's about the mind, the body, the spirit.
And it emphasizes the importance of considering those psychological and social impacts of IBD.
Yeah, because those can be huge.
They can. You know, fatigue, pain, social stigma, all of those can affect work, relationships, quality of life.
Absolutely, and we need to be sensitive to those issues.
And then patient education,
Oh, that's crucial.
shared decision making.
Patients need to be empowered to make decisions about their own health.
They do.
And we need to be good listeners.
Right.
We need to understand their concerns.
And respect their preferences.
Absolutely, it's a partnership.
Now that we've covered the key points from this IBD revision document, I think it'd be really helpful to apply this knowledge to some concrete scenarios.
I agree. I love case studies.
And the document includes a few.
Oh, perfect.
So let's start with a case that really focuses on the importance of distinguishing between ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease.
All right, let's do it.
So this first case presents a 32-year-old woman with a 6-week history of bloody diarrhea, urgency, and tenesmus.
Okay, so those classic symptoms that could point to either UC or Crohn's.
She's also experiencing fatigue and has lost 5 kilograms,
All right.
but denies any abdominal pain, fever, or extraintestinal symptoms.
So significant bowel symptoms, but no red flags in her history.
Her medical history is unremarkable, and she doesn't smoke or drink alcohol.
Okay, so pretty healthy otherwise.
On examination, she appears pale, but otherwise her vitals are stable.
Okay.
Abdominal examination reveals mild lower abdominal tenderness,
All right.
but no masses or organomegaly.
So consistent with inflammation in the colon, but not specific.
Right. Those initial bloods show iron deficiency anemia,
Not surprising.
Given the bleeding
right.
and an elevated CRP.
Okay, so definitely inflammation.
So IBD is high on the list, but we need to figure out, is it UC or Crohn's?
Exactly.
Colonoscopy is the next step.
Absolutely, got to visualize that mucosa.
Get those biopsies.
Get that histology.
So in this case, colonoscopy reveals continuous inflammation extending from the rectum to the splenic flexure.
Okay, so we're talking pancolitis.
There's loss of vascular pattern, the mucosa is friable, and there are some superficial ulcerations.
Sounds like UC.
And the biopsies show goblet cell depletion, crypt abscesses, crypt architectural distortion, but no granulomas.
So those are all classic for UC.
Right. And the absence of granulomas really helps rule out Crohn's.
Exactly.
So we have our diagnosis.
Now we need to figure out how severe it is.
Right. And we can use that Mayo score.
Yep.
Taking into account her stool frequency, rectal bleeding, endoscopic finding.
The whole picture.
Her Mayo score is 9.
Okay. So moderate disease.
Moderate disease. So how would you approach treatment?
So I'd start with induction therapy using 5-ASA.
Okay.
So we could consider oral mesalazine, 2 to 3 grams daily, plus those rectal mesalazine enemas.
Okay.
To get that added topical benefit.
Right. And of course, we monitor closely.
Oh, absolutely.
For response and side effects.
Always monitoring an IBD.
And if she doesn't respond to 5-ASA or if her disease progresses.
Then we think about escalating therapy.
Right. So steroids.
Maybe even a biologic.
Mm-hmm. So this case really shows how we take that systematic approach.
Yeah, it's all about the steps.
To evaluate and manage these patients.
History, exam, investigations, treatment.
And distinguish between UC and CD.
And then tailor that treatment plan.
Now, let's move on to a case that highlights that urgency of managing acute severe ulcerative colitis.
Okay, so high stakes.
This case involves a 25-year-old man presenting to the ED with a 3-day history of worsening bloody diarrhea, abdominal pain, and fever.
Uh-oh, that's not good.
He's having more than 10 bowel movements per day.
Wow.
Severe urgency, tenesmus. Oh. He's known UC, diagnosed 2 years ago, previously well-managed on mesalazine.
All right.
But he stopped taking it because of stress at work.
Yeah, classic scenario.
Right, stress.
Med non-adherence.
So on exam, tachycardia, hypotension, fever.
So we got that systemic inflammatory response.
His abdomen is distended and tender with generalized guarding.
Sounds like peritonitis.
Bloods reveal leukocytosis.
Okay.
Hypokalemia, hypomagnesemia.
Got to correct those electrolytes quickly.
His CRP is significantly elevated.
Right.
A plain abdominal x-ray shows colonic dilation.
Okay.
Particularly in that transverse colon, measuring 6 centimeters in diameter.
So that, along with the clinical picture, confirms toxic megacolon, high risk of perforation.
So medical emergency.
Absolutely. Got to get this guy to the ICU.
Intravenous fluids.
Electrolyte repletion.
Broad spectrum antibiotics.
We'll cover that bacterial translocation.
And avoid any meds that could worsen the dilation. So no opioids, no antidiarrheals.
Right. Those are absolute no-nos.
Intravenous corticosteroids.
To calm down that inflammation.
And we're monitoring his progress closely.
Stool frequency, vitals, inflammatory markers.
Right. Looking for improvement or deterioration.
And we're thinking about those Travis criteria.
Right. So with his CRP and stool frequency, his risk of colectomy is high.
Yeah. We need to have that tough conversation with him and his family.
Right. Surgery might be necessary.
An early surgical consult is key.
Absolutely. So this case really shows the importance of recognizing
and acting quickly
that acute severe UC.
Because delays can be deadly.
They can. Now let's move on to a case focusing on long-term management of UC and that risk of colorectal cancer.
Okay, so thinking about the long game now.
This case involves a 50-year-old man with a 20-year history of extensive ulcerative colitis.
So long-standing inflammation.
Mm-hmm. He's been in remission for the past 5 years on azathioprine. Reports good health. His last surveillance colonoscopy 2 years ago showed quiescent colitis, no dysplasia.
So he's doing well, but we still need to be vigilant.
Right. So what are the key considerations for his long-term management?
Well, even though he's in remission, he's still at increased risk of colorectal cancer.
Because of that long-standing inflammation.
Exactly. So surveillance is key.
Right. And the guidelines recommend colonoscopy every 1 to 3 years.
Yeah. We have to balance the benefits of surveillance against the risks of those repeat procedures.
And then there's the azathioprine.
Yeah. It's worked well for him.
Right. But those long-term side effects, mild suppression, hepatotoxicity.
And that increased risk of certain cancers.
So we need to have that discussion with him.
Absolutely. It's about shared decision making.
Right. Weighing the benefits against the risks.
And we can't forget about lifestyle modifications.
Right. Smoking cessation, healthy diet.
Those can make a big difference.
They can. So this case really highlights those long-term implications of UC.
It's a chronic disease.
Even when it's well-controlled.
We need to stay on top of it.
Okay, now let's move on to Crohn's and those perianal fistulae.
Okay, those are always fun.
This case is a 45-year-old man with 10-year history of ileocolonic Crohn's.
All right.
He presents with persistent perianal pain in discharge.
So perianal disease, as we expected.
He has a history of recurrent fistulae.
Okay.
Despite antibiotics and immunomodulators.
So we're dealing with more aggressive disease here.
On exam, a palpable perianal abscess.
Can you drain that?
And a complex fistula tract extending from the anal canal to the skin.
This is going to be a challenge.
So what are our priorities?
Control that infection first.
Right. So incision and drainage of the abscess.
Sure. And then,
address the fistula.
So seton placement is often the first step.
Okay.
Helps to drain it, promote healing.
And then we got to get that underlying Crohn's under control.
Right. Because that's what's driving the fistula.
So immunomodulators.
Like azathioprine or 6-mercaptopurine.
And if those don't work.
Biologics.
Like infliximab or dalmomab.
And sometimes surgery is the only option.
Especially for those complex fistulae.
Right. And these are decisions that we make with our surgical colleagues.
It's that team approach.
Multidisciplinary care.
Now, our final case is going to be on post-op management of Crohn's.
Okay. Sounds good.
So this is a 30-year-old woman, 5-year history of ileal Crohn's.
All right.
She undergoes an ileocecal resection for a stricturing lesion.
Okay. So they removed the diseased section.
She's a smoker.
Another risk factor.
And she's required 2 courses of steroids in the past year.
So active disease, risk factors for recurrence.
Her post-op colonoscopy shows a Rutgert score of 2.
More than 5 ulcers, but normal mucosa in between.
What are we thinking about in terms of post-op management?
Well, given her Rutgert score and her risk factors, we're definitely considering prophylactic therapy.
Right. And both ECCO and BSG have guidelines for this.
What do they recommend?
ECCO recommends restarting azathioprine or an anti-TNF.
Okay.
If they have at least 1 risk factor.
Makes sense.
BSG recommends metronidazole for everyone.
Okay.
But they add additional therapy if they're a smoker or have 2 or more risk factors.
So in this case, with her smoking and the recent steroids, she would qualify for that more aggressive approach.
Right. Shared decision making.
Absolutely.
But got to emphasize that smoking cessation.
Every time we see her.
Right. And, of course, regular follow-up.
Clinical assessments, monitoring those inflammatory markers, repeat endoscopies.
So these 5 cases really highlight the complexities.
Yeah, it's not always straightforward.
Of managing IBD.
Lots of nuances.
And the importance of staying up to date.
On the latest guidelines and research.
Absolutely. So as we wrap up this deep dive into the world of IBD, let's leave our listeners with a thought-provoking question.
Okay, I like it.
Given the intricacies of IBD management, how would you approach personalizing treatment plans for patients with specific risk factors and diverse disease phenotypes?
That's a great question. It really challenges us to think beyond those algorithms and guidelines.
Right. It's about integrating that knowledge.
With clinical judgment.
And patient-centered care.
To develop those truly individualized plans.
We wish you the best of luck on your SCE exam prep.
You got this.
Remember, it's not just about knowing the facts.
It's about applying them.
And don't hesitate to revisit this document and the insights we've shared.
We're here to help.
Best of luck.
You're going to do great.